From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, local advocates react to a series of moves by the Trump administration on immigration.
Every single opportunity that they have been able to find to make life more uncomfortable for immigrants, to spread fear, they do not miss an opportunity to strike.
Also today, Boston City Councilor Anissa Asaibi George says we need to think bigger than supervised consumption sites when it comes to addiction.
When you think about the millions of dollars that it costs to open one site, I want to invest those in actions that we can do today and tomorrow to save lives.
And what makes a great end of summer read?
One of those books that you can read in bits and pieces and like chew on like a box of gourmet chocolates, or you can just kind of like eat them all in one sitting and you're like in a carb coma, like in the best way.
We'll share our faves and get yours next on WBUR's Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show. This show originally aired earlier today.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. The Trump White House has made a number of significant moves on immigration policy this month, from changes in the public charge rules, which was a move that had been long planned, to the sudden announcements that asylum officers in Boston would be moved to the border, and immigrations with deportation deferrals due to severe medical conditions now have 33 days to leave the country. And then the Washington Post reported this week that President Trump suggested he would pardon aides if they broke the law in order to get the border wall built before the next election. The White House says he was joking. That's not even all of it. It feels like a month that has changed the game on immigration policy, even in an administration that has been restricting immigration from the start. So joining us to talk about all of this on the line is Sarah Sherman Stokes, who's the Associate Director of the Immigrants' Rights and Human Trafficking Clinic at Boston University Law School. Hello.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for joining us. So, Sarah, things really heated up last week when WBUR first reported that U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, or USCIS, notified local immigration attorneys that asylum officers from Boston would be sent to the southwest border with Mexico in order to address the influx of asylum seekers there. And then this week, WBUR broke the now national story of the sudden cancellation of medical deferred action for some immigrants. You know, looking across all of this, a lot of policy moves, big ones in a relatively short period of time, it feels to us like there is something different going on. Does it feel different to you?
I would say yes and no. On one hand, it's important to situate this in the context of this administration's ongoing and pretty relentless war on immigrants, on both immigrants who are authorized to be here, as well as immigrants seeking asylum here and refuge. These big policy changes that you're speaking of are alarming and devastating, but they're also part of a larger protracted pattern of changes that deeply impact immigrants and their families.
So, Sarah, they feel like they're coming at a little bit faster clip in the last few weeks, and maybe in some cases, and we can dive more into this, but maybe in some cases without necessarily the proper planning or preparation for implementation behind them. What's your reaction to that? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I absolutely agree that a lot of these policies and changes are being rolled out without a lot of thought. For example, when we think about the end of deferred action for people with serious medical and mental health conditions, which you mentioned earlier, this is a plan that clearly was rolled out without a lot of planning. USCIS said we're no longer going to be providing deferred action to these critically ill people, including children. And in fact, ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, will be taking care of that policy. We now know that ICE said, we know nothing about that. We don't know what you're talking about. We've reached out to USCIS. So clearly there wasn't any coordination whatsoever. And we're talking about the lives of people who are really potentially at risk if this program ends, which it appears it will be.
Let's talk about those lives, because WBUR's Shannon Dooling spoke with Jonathan Sanchez. He's a 16-year-old from Honduras. He has cystic fibrosis. His family entered the U.S. on tourist visas in 2016. First, they were able to extend him, but the treatment was longer than their original six-month extension, so they applied for this medical deferral. Now the teen says he's feeling stressed and scared that he might actually have to leave the U.S.
If they deny the program, that I need to go back to my country, and I'll probably die. Because in my country, there's no treatment for CF. Doctors don't even know what's the disease. The only ones who can help me are here in the United States.
Rapid change, unexpected change, confusion around implementation of those changes. What does this kind of uncertainty do to the people the changes affect?
Absolutely. And first, I mean, that listening to that young man speak, is extremely upsetting. It's almost as if the administration, thought, well, we've put children in cages, we've left thousands of people waiting for asylum in Mexico, we've separated families. You know, what more can we do to harm the most vulnerable? And it seems like with this deferred action program, they've found some of the most vulnerable people in our communities to target. And they've done so in a way that, as you say, sows fear and chaos. And I think, unfortunately, that's exactly the point, that if they can make people scramble, if they can increase uncertainty, I think their hope is that people will just sort of quietly leave. But when we're talking about children and families who have lived in this country for years, people who are afraid to go back to their home countries because they're going to be harmed, and people that can't have access to the medical care they need to survive, those people aren't going to be able to just leave the United States quietly.
So, Sarah, you're saying that this, you know, sort of sloppy implementation, or this sense that maybe there's a lack of administrative preparedness that leads to chaos, you're saying that's a feature, not a bug.
It's hard to think otherwise at this point. We've seen such a pattern of this administration creating a crisis through whether it be poor planning or just cruelty. They create a crisis. They refuse to take responsibility for the crisis they've created, and then they purport to rescue us from the crisis that they alone created. That seems to be somewhat of the playbook, at least as regards the immigration policy of this administration.
All right. I want to bring another voice into this conversation. Marian Davis is the spokesperson for the Massachusetts Immigrant and Refugee Advocacy Coalition. It's also known as MIRA. Marian, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
So how is MIRA reacting to and responding to this sort of series of changes that have come out in the last few weeks?
We have been pretty much, we are working nonstop on this stuff, and it's really, really hard to keep up because, as you said, it's just been unrelenting, and we were particularly focused on this medical deferred action situation. We work at Irish International Immigrant Center, which sort of broke the story from an advocacy perspective. They are our members, and they reached out to us, and we worked closely with them to start doing media outreach and to organize a press conference on Monday, and to also reach out to our congressional delegation and to advocates across the country to help start building momentum about this, because, it's shocking. We've come to see, like as Sarah said, we've seen so many horrible things that we keep thinking they can't go any lower. And deporting kids with cancer is actually a new low point. And I think we all think on this team, like, this is a scandal, and it requires scandal level proportion of coverage and of anger and of outrage and of public uprising against it, because it's just, they have completely lost any perspective on the humanity of immigrants, and this cannot be accepted. This is not about politics, and it's most certainly not about policy anymore. This is about just behaving in atrocious and beastly ways that
right.
we cannot accept.
Okay, but so Marian and Sarah, how would you respond to people who say that the U.S. not only has to but has the right to limit the number of people that the country takes in, and that we have things to do to address the full gamut of immigration policies in order to ensure that they, reflect American priorities?
Sure. I think you know, that presents us with a potentially a false choice, right? That the choice is either sort of open borders, allow everyone, or engage in the kinds of enforcement that this administration would have us believe are required. And we don't have to choose one of those things. We can have a humane immigration policy that doesn't put families in custody, that doesn't put kids in cages, that doesn't separate families, that doesn't deport children receiving treatment for cystic fibrosis in Boston. But that also keeps our country safe. There are plenty of politicians and advocacy groups that have put together humane platforms for immigration policy. To suggest that it's an either or, I think is really a false choice. And there is more nuance to be had here.
So, Marion, building on Sarah's point of a false choice, if this were done more humanely, would MIRA still have a problem with the changes that are being made? Is this about how they're being done, or is it about that they're being done?
I think it's a combination of both. I think some things, I mean, there's the medical deferred action program, for example, it's a tiny program. We're talking about, you know, a thousand or so cases get processed every year is our understanding. Across the entire country. It really does not in any way affect America as a whole to have 1,000 sick people who would die in their home countries be able to stay here. And they are doing everything by the book. Every single person who gets this particular status is working with lawyers, filing paperwork, documenting their cases meticulously. These are not people who are in any way breaking any laws. They are actually abiding by the law. And I think the problem is that there's this idea now that just being an immigrant is somehow an undesirable and bad thing. And there's a lot of demonization. So I agree with Sarah. I mean, we can be humane and we can be at the same time, you know, a nation of laws and do things by the book.
Sarah, in the last 24 hours or so, the administration has also introduced a rule that would make it more difficult for the children of some U.S. service members and U.S. government employees who live abroad to automatically become U.S. citizens. Is there something sort of, are we shooting ourselves in the foot with that one? That feels counterintuitive, even to the types of policies the Trump administration has laid out around immigration and national security. What's your response to that?
Sure. And before, I just do want to clarify that there's pretty much no way in which the administration could end this medical deferred action program that I personally would think was okay. So I don't want to make it seem
that's
that
helpful.
They just should have done this in another way. I certainly don't think there's any humane way to end a program that is literally saving the lives of people who are, undergoing serious medical treatment. On the point about U.S. citizenship for children of U.S. service members, I think what this is about is a manifestation of this administration's attack on authorized immigration, right? So it's not just that this administration is demonizing and, you know, using lots of racist rhetoric around undocumented immigrants, but around immigrants generally. And I couldn't agree more with Marion and the folks at MIRA that, you know, talking about the ways in which just being an immigrant is sort of a dirty word under this administration. And this latest attack, which precisely says that those children of U.S. service members who are not themselves U.S. citizens, we're talking about lawful permanent residents. I think there was some miscommunication and misinformation about how this was rolled out, which, again, you know, goes to your earlier point about the chaos and the lack of planning that goes into rolling out these policy announcements. It does appear, although, again, it's not completely clear, but it does appear that this will apply to children of lawful permanent residents, people with green cards, who would have considered to have been residing in the United States even when they were with their parent living abroad for purposes of later naturalizing. And then that no longer will be the case. So what this will do, it will, again, create uncertainty. It will create fear. It will create anxiety. It will require folks to pay for lawyers to get consultations about how it is they can go about proving residency and acquiring citizenship later on. So it will cost people money. And we're talking about people that have, you know, sacrificed their lives and their families' lives to potentially go abroad and serve this country. It is quite, I think, shocking that this administration would go after this group. On the other hand, this administration has made it really clear that they intend to attack both authorized and unauthorized immigration.
I want to get one more question in. Marion, is MIRA doing any contingency planning? Is there something you're preparing for that could come down the pike next?
Our hope is that, you know, we know that there are legal advocates working right now on medical deferred action in particular to file, you know, looking at how to file lawsuits to stop this. But, I mean, this is being fought out on every front. And this is, you know, like Sarah said also, you know, one of the biggest fights that we're having right now is on public charge, which is this new rule to basically, you know, keep out working class immigrants is what it will effectively do. Because, you know, and these are people entering lawfully and all of that. So,
sorry to interrupt you, Marianne. I got to stop you there. But yeah. Thank you. That's Marianne Davis, spokesperson for MIRA. Thanks for joining us at Radio Boston.
Thank you so much.
And Shara Sermon Stokes is the associate director of the Immigrants' Rights and Human Trafficking Clinic at Boston University Law School. Thanks, Sarah.
Thank you so much.
Stay tuned. There's more coming up here on Radio Boston. Boston City Councilor Anissa Asaibi George says we need to think bigger when it comes to the addiction crisis. We'll hear from her. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. What should Boston do in the face of a major addiction crisis? One controversial proposal would create supervised consumption sites, or places where people can consume drugs under the supervision of trained staff. Advocates like Paul Bowman of the Boston Users Union say they reduce overdoses and save lives.
People are using wherever there's a place to use, unfortunately. So if we had a safe place, that at least you'd have less of a chance of maybe a really bad outcome.
Critics point out that the evidence of their success is mixed and that these sites are illegal. Here's U.S. Attorney Andrew Lelling.
I want everyone to be very clear about this. Not only would it be illegal to open one, but we would pursue enforcement if they did open one.
Boston City Councilor Anissa Asaibi George, chair of the Committee on Homelessness, Mental Health, and Recovery, is just back from Toronto, where she was looking into their approach to addiction, including supervised consumption sites. She came by Studio 3 earlier today, and she told us why she made the trip.
I went to see the supervised consumption sites, or supervised injection sites for sure, but I went for really an opportunity to explore what are the opportunities that we're missing here in Boston, what's happening in Toronto in comparison to what I saw in Vancouver last year, what I know is happening right now in the city, and how can we improve our ability to care for people who are sick in our city.
When you went to Vancouver, after that visit, you sort of expressed, I don't know if this is the right word, but some disappointment in terms of the relevance of what you saw there for what could be solutions here in Boston. Were they doing something different in Toronto than in Vancouver that you thought held more promise for us here in the greater Boston area?
Yeah, I would say absolutely yes. Two very different systems and two very different ways of delivering care. And what stood out to me the most in Toronto was this very regional and coordinated approach to harm reduction. And the response to in Toronto is no longer just specifically around the opioid crisis, but it's how they're responding to the drug crisis, how they're responding to the needs, the mental health needs of their residents, how they're responding to the need for housing services across their city. And Toronto is a much larger city than Boston. And for me, it's about what are those pieces that we can take and replicate here. And for me, I'm very excited about how we move forward in integrating harm reduction in more of our work across the city and across the region, how we take what might be working in one or two places, expanding that, and doing it in partnership with other cities and towns.
So part of the harm reduction landscape are supervised consumption sites. And you had originally essentially not been in favor of supervised consumption sites. Last time we talked to you before you went to Toronto, you expressed some skepticism about them. Have you changed your thinking on supervised consumption sites as a result of your visit to Toronto?
My position hasn't changed on the supervised consumption sites, but what I do, what I've learned on this trip about that integration of multiple types of services being provided, in whether it's a safe injection site or whether it's throughout any of their other harm reduction programs. In Toronto, they have 9 sites and an additional 50 providers of harm reduction services, and they're all connected. They all do services slightly different so that they could be responsive to the needs of an individual, of someone dealing with substance use disorders. For example, there's one clinic in particular that works very specifically with women, and they're doing work around recovery, but they're also doing work around health issues, around prenatal care if the woman is pregnant, around domestic violence. And that, to me, that specialized, that ability to give that specialized care to individuals that are in crisis is really very, was very appealing to me. A place that Toronto was missing some opportunities that we do a better job, I think, here in the States and certainly in the Boston area, is access to detox care. We both lack, both in Toronto and in Vancouver and in Boston, we all lack direct access to recovery beds. We know for every 30 individuals that are looking for a recovery bed, we only have one available. That's a huge missing component in this work, and one that we need to make sure that we're focused on as a city and as a state.
You know, in talking, you're focusing really heavily on harm reduction. I'm a little surprised that you didn't come back feeling differently about supervised consumption sites, given the emphasis you're putting on harm reduction, because they, you know, the science shows that they do at least reduce the risk of death from abuse. Let's hear from Cambridge Mayor Mark McGovern, who says that he's supporting creating a supervised consumption site in his own city.
You know, this is about harm reduction. You can't get someone into treatment if they're dead. And I hate to be so crass, but that's what we're talking about here. And there has never been an overdose death in a safe consumption site.
So he too cares about harm reduction. He's come to a different conclusion. Right. How do you square that?
Well, I do agree that there are no deaths within safe consumption sites. But in Toronto, one of the things that they're looking at is because they recognize outside of the hours of operation, people are dying outside of safe consumption sites. So they're looking at the need to do this 24 hours a day. They're also looking at the need to expand it to these additional 50 locations to really spread the effort across the region. But one of the other pieces is some of the success they have found in reaching people who are in crisis is the relationship they've built through some of the harm reduction efforts.
We talked to you last time before Somerville Mayor Joe Curtatone announced that he wanted to do a supervised consumption site in Somerville. You've now been to Toronto. You've talked about this landscape. The landscape seems, the suite of services seems to be the thing that really drew you or impressed you in Toronto. So why cut out this one piece of the solution set, especially when we're seeing mayors in our own area saying, hey, we've come to the conclusion that it's time to do this?
No, well, so where I am and what it is that we need to be doing right now is saving lives today. The process to open a safe consumption site is well down the road. We know what the U.S. attorney feels about that. We know the rules around some of the federal legislation, the federal rules that will govern whether or not these can open. We know that people are dying today in our city. There are pieces of this that we can do today. We think about the millions of dollars that it costs to open one site. I want to invest those in actions that we can do today and tomorrow to save lives. And through harm reduction, through safe needle exchange, through a better distribution of methadone and Suboxone, and really providing the mental health services and the housing needs and the other supportive services that individuals who are in crisis need, we can help them find recovery. We need to continue to invest in detox. We have to find a way to create a pipeline of supportive recovery options for individuals dealing with the crisis today. Safe consumption sites, are certainly a part of the conversation and they'll continue to be a part of the conversation. But there are things that are happening in Toronto today that we could put into effect tomorrow in the city of Boston and in the region.
Okay, so what's one of the first investments that you think you would want to make? So I'm hearing, what I think I'm hearing from you, let me feed it back to you to make sure I'm here understanding you right. There's an urgency here that makes you want to prioritize now immediate investments that produce immediate returns in harm reduction and death reduction. What are some of the, you know, quick hits? Hey, we could make good investments right away with little, you know, oversight hurdles or that kind of thing that you think the city needs to do next.
Well, I think it's first making sure that all of our work is coordinated in its approach, that we have enough recovery beds. We need 2,500 recovery beds. We can do a few of these immediately. We can't do all 2,500 in the very near future, but that has to be a working goal. That has to be part of the checklist that every single day we're looking at each other and saying how many new recovery beds are available for individuals who are looking for them. And it's also about getting naloxone into more hands and more a more thoughtful approach around educating individuals on how to use naloxone, to, if you are dealing with substance use disorder, to not use alone. And in Toronto, they've done a very, very directed public awareness and public education campaign around not using alone. And some of the data that I received that, you know, I got in last night at midnight, so I don't have it at my fingertips. The response for our local EMS in Boston, we've responded to say 3,800, almost 4,000 overdose calls, not deaths, but overdose calls. In Toronto, a population that is 2.4 million compared to Boston's, you know, 650,000-700,000 population, they've received only several hundred calls for overdose because naloxone is in their communities across the city, across the entire region. And, you know, it is a much larger city than Boston is. So when we think about this regional approach, it's about public education, it's about naloxone in everyone's hands, and it's really about recovery beds. So we have detox on demand. We can get folks into detox. It's getting them into those step-down and longer treatment beds that we can really see some critical gains in fighting this opioid epidemic.
Why don't we have more naloxone on the ground now when it has such a strong impact on people who are suffering from addiction?
Well, I think there's still a lot of fear and stigma associated with carrying naloxone, picking it up at your pharmacy, getting it from maybe our one or two or small handful of places where we can get it. And that's part of harm reduction. All of these sites across Toronto, almost 60 of them that are doing this work very actively, are giving out naloxone. It is in everyone's hands in Toronto. You know, we need to get naloxone into more hands. We need to do a lot more education around about not using alone. We need to make sure that we've got a coordinated response and integrated approach to this work, and that anyone dealing with substance use disorders has an active community in which to engage to access resources. And that's, I think, the bigger picture of harm reduction. And it really has to be, it has to be happening in so many more places than just here or there, just in a few places in the city of Boston. It has to be widespread, again, across the greater Boston region.
This is a regional issue, as you just said. How do you bring all the necessary players to the table in a meaningful way to address regional strategies to addiction right now?
I'd say that's my charge. That's what I've come home with. And I think that's the task at my hand as an elected official, as the chair of the Committee on Homelessness, Mental Health and Recovery. This is the work that's left for me now.
Boston City Councilor Anissa Esaibi-George. She is the chair of the Committee on Homelessness, Mental Health and Recovery. Thanks so much for coming to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Coming up in these final days of summer, what's the one book we should be reading? Give us a call, 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. If you were to check out my nightstand at home, you would find what I call an ambitious stack of nonfiction, big, serious tomes that I've been meaning to get to all summer, but I have not yet. You know, it's the kind of books you want to get to, but I need a nice block of relaxed time like Labor Day weekend. For many, that's the opportunity to relax, enjoy a good book, maybe two books. If you're really greedy, maybe three. So, before we say goodbye to the warm days of summer, what are you reading? What's the one book you've read this summer that you'd like to suggest to others for this final summer weekend? Call us, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. So with us in Studio 3 is author Jennifer DeLeon. She edited the anthology Wise Latinas, Writers on Higher Education. She's an English professor at Framingham State University and a writing instructor at Grub Street. Jen, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much for having me.
Also with us is Nick Petrolakis. He's the assistant manager of Brookline Booksmith. Nick, welcome.
Thank you so much.
So my nightstand, you both kind of smiled at that. Does everyone have this problem? There's too many good books, not enough time? Nick.
Absolutely. Thankfully, I'm a new transplant from the Bay Area here, so there are no earthquakes here, because if there were an earthquake, you would find my entire family buried under the deluge.
Oh, so. Of books, you mean,
yes.
Falling over. I was not sure where you were going with that at first, Nick, but we got there. Jen, how about you? Do you have a big stack of your own at home?
Absolutely. And you can see my husband's stack is neatly piled, and mine is just like, like a bomb went off. Like books halved, random bookmarks, folded pages.
The
whole thing.
All right. So before we get to specific suggestions, which we will do, many of them actually, what makes a good end of summer read, Jen?
Oh, my goodness. I'm reading year round. So I always am thinking about what makes a good book. But there's something about the end of the summer where you feel like you're just inhaling your last big breath before the push of the fall. So there's I love a long story, you know, a novel or a memoir. It's not the time of year where I'm thinking so much about essays or stories. I just want to do a deep last dive into a long story, close the book, and then I can begin in September.
All right. So, Nick, what are you seeing at Brookline Booksmith? Is there a particular kind of trend you're seeing in what people are buying this summer or usually buy in the summer?
You know, we're pretty lucky that the readers in Boston are very omnivorous. And so, you know, all through the year, we're selling, nonfiction, fiction, deliciously paced books, deeper, longer books. Although in the summer, yes, are people, grabbing, a mystery to throw into their bag as they, head off to, the vineyard? Absolutely. Overall, people buy so many different things. It's just wonderful.
All right. So it is time to go into recommendations, and let's actually start with local books, okay? Any recommendations by local authors or that are set in New England? Jen?
Definitely. I can't wait to talk about this book. It's a memoir by Grace Tallulah. It's called The Body Papers. It's the winner of the Restless Books Prize for New Immigrant Writing. Grace is a local writer, and she's been publishing essays for years, and I always describe them as these like rich chocolates. And so you can read them in her memoir a bit at a time, or you can just kind of eat the whole box at the same time, one sitting.
That started to be my preference. How about you, Nick? What do you have for local?
You know, it's funny, the book that Jen just talked about, we had the launch for The Body Papers, and it is really, truly remarkable. It is, such a personal story. Profoundly painful. And I think that what Grace did, really, you know, bearing, you know, her soul for us is remarkable. So that's funny that you immediately went to the body papers, because as far as local writers go, oh my gosh, that also is definitely right at the top of my list.
But not the one you picked. So what did you pick?
You know, so I had a list of books, but I did not have specific to Boston picks. And of course, I'm that terrible bookseller who, when put on the spot, I'm like, oh my gosh, Boston.
No problem, because I have one.
And me too.
So let me do mine. All right. So, and this is not a new book, but the book is Defending Jacob, and it's a novel by William Landay. And the reason that I recommend it is twofold. One, they're shooting a series based on the book in our community. They were just in Newton Highlands actually a couple of weeks ago, and there's been shooting going on around the area. But two, it's about a murder that takes place in a middle school and the rending of the fabric of the family and the school community. And as we prepare to enter back into the school year, there's kind of a relevance to that that I think is interesting. We've got some callers, though, so let's take some calls. 1-800-423-8255 is the number. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Anne from Ashland, what do you got on your list?
Well, I think the best thing I read all summer was The Nickel Boys by Colson Whitehead. Thought it was fantastic. Wonderful story of friendship and love and sacrifice.
Why did it stand out? Of everything you read this summer, why did it stand out?
Just because it was so compelling. It's the story, it's the fictionalized story of the juvenile jail that was in Florida, where they found so many bodies after the juvenile detention center closed. They found, you know, unmarked graves of hundreds of young men, and this is a fictionalized version of that story. So it's really compelling, and the main character in it is just wonderful.
That's great, Anne. Thanks for the call and the recommendation. Let's take one more. Ryan from Framingham, what's your recommendation?
My recommendation is Warriors by Erin Hunter. It was a very suspenseful book, and the plot was pretty exciting. It didn't take long to get into the, like, main part of the book, and that's why I really liked it, because some books take like a while to get into the main good part of the book, and that's why I enjoyed it so much.
Ryan, we love young listeners. How old are you?
I am 12 years old.
And did you read this book like a little bit at a time, or did you just kind of eat it all at once like a big box of chocolates?
I kind of just ate it all at once.
Awesome. Ryan, thanks so much for your call. That was just great. Before we go off local books, one of our producers, Jamie Bologna, also wanted to offer up a local pick called Leading Men by Boston's Christopher Castellani. He says it fills in the gaps of history by reimagining the love between playwright Tennessee Williams and his lover Frank Merlo. They met in Provincetown in the late 1940s. They continued a relationship until the early 60s. Jen, you're nodding. Is this a book that you know?
Yes. In fact, Chris Castellani is a dear friend, and I'm in a writing group with him and with Grace Tolusen. So I'm thrilled to be able to champion that book even more.
All right. So, Nick, let's talk fiction more broadly. Why do you think fiction is the most popular genre during the summer?
You know, I think it's just an easy escape. You know, I mean, the news always can be horrific, but I feel like, you know, especially in 2019, you can't turn around with, you know, social media and not be faced with the latest horror show. And I think that people need a release. And so sometimes it's easier to pick up a book that is a fictionalized account of people who have been made up, but that you learn, you know, to know as if they were real people. And you just, you know, want to turn off. And fiction really just allows, you know, a window into, you know, a better place sometimes.
So what's the best book on your list, fiction-wise, to turn off with this weekend on this long Labor Day?
I mean, you know, Nickel Boys, I have to say, also like The Caller, that is, you know, truly amazing. There's, you know, a great line in it that Whitehead writes that, you know, the boys that he's talking about never figured out how to be normal because of the horrors that were inflicted on them. So that book is terrific. But there's, you know, I mean, the Leading Men is great for, you know, local. Also, Bunny is by a, you know, local author, Mona Awad. It is truly amazing. It's a story of prep school and a writing program, and she can very easily have fallen into just throwing darts at people that are stereotypically, you know, in college and learning how to write, and instead she just brings a depth to it. But it's absolutely laugh out loud funny. So Bunny is just terrific.
Excellent. So our lines are full, so let's take some calls for 1-800-423-8255. Doug from Boxford, what's your recommendation?
Yes, hi. I'd like to strongly recommend a thriller, a different type of genre, called In the Mist of the Sea by a local artist, Sean Fedraic McCarthy. It's a book which takes place in Martha's Vineyard, which makes it even more exciting, both in the present and also in the past. And it's such a haunting thriller, I actually have been thinking about it on almost a daily basis since I've read it. But it's very well crafted and keeps your interest going tremendously.
That's
great summer read.
That's fantastic, Doug. I love the haunting stuff that kind of lurks over you for days afterward. Let's take one more call right now. Gloria from Cambridge, what's your recommendations? People are going to read one book this weekend. You say they should read...
Absolutely. Lewis Terkel's The Good War, written about 50 years ago, about that war.
About, and when you say that war, do you mean
World War II?
Yeah.
World War II.
Yeah.
That's why it was called The Good War, because that's an oxymoron, and that's how he meant it. But it was so amazing, because he remember when he wrote Working, and you thought, what could be more boring, saying, hi, tell me about your job, the opposite.
All right.
And that's what this book was like. Everybody from a grunt to the Andrew sisters who were in that war, and I don't know how the heck we won it, but we did.
Well, that's a great recommendation, Gloria. Thanks. And Jen, let me come back to you. Did you bring in a fiction book you wanted to recommend for the listeners?
I do. I'm really torn because I have a couple, so I will just mention one that is kind of an escape novel. It's called The Stationery Shop by Marjan Kamali, and it's been described as the Notebook in Iran. So it's a love story, and it's got an amazing premise. This young couple, they meet in a stationery shop, and they want to build their life together, so they agree to meet one night in the park, and that night the coup starts in Iran. And so what happens is he doesn't show. And 50 years pass where she doesn't know what happened. And fate has it so that she finds him in a nursing home all these years later. And the book opens that way where she asks him, what happened to you? Why didn't you come?
Oh my God, you said he doesn't show, and my heart sang. It's like I'm already reading the book. I'm like,
yeah.
No, he
right.
asked.
Yeah, how can you not read that book to the end?
Yeah.
But one that I am devouring right now, and I'm reading it for the second time, it's called Where We Come From by Oscar Casares. He is from Texas, and this novel tells a story of a woman in Brownsville, so on the U.S.-Mexico border, and she is hiding migrants in her backyard in a shed, and one of the boys gets left behind.
Oh.
So the coyotes leave, and there's an 11-year-old boy in there who's left behind. And, I mean, it's very intense and timely and dark and important, but it's also a really funny book, and one that I just am so fascinated and impressed by the dialogue, because you have characters speaking in Spanish to each other, but the text is in English, and the author acknowledges the cadence of the rhythm of the language of Spanish. And I've never seen that done so well, and I'm so impressed. I can't wait to teach this book and just give it to everybody I know. So don't be afraid of the dark subject. It's an amazing novel.
So I'm going to throw in kind of a clever book called Mostly Dead Things by Kristen Arnett. It was her debut book. We spoke to her on Radio Boston this summer. I'm going to let her give the elevator pitch for the book.
Lesbian taxidermist in Central Florida takes over her family's taxidermy business after her father commits suicide in the taxidermy shop.
Swear to God, that's what the book is about. Wow. Nick, you're laughing. Is it
well, we
it's
had
funny,
her
you know
at the Booksmith for an event, and she is just charming and funny, and the book is delightful and just exactly that.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Let's take some calls. Jane from Gloucester, go ahead.
Hi. Yeah. I want to recommend a book by an author who actually also happens to be from Gloucester. It's the novel's called The Mercy Seat by Elizabeth H. Winthrop. And it's about the traveling electric chair in Louisiana in 1943, and it's a novel.
Hmm.
And I just haven't been able to stop thinking about it since I read it, and particularly because even though it takes place in 1943, I think it brings up a lot of issues that are still relevant today in terms of race and capital punishment.
That's really profound thought. I mean, it seems kind of haunting. When did you read it, Jane?
I actually read it. It came out, I think, in 2018, but I didn't read it until this summer when it was out in paperback.
Yeah, I think I was asking because you were saying it, you know, it really stayed with you. Has this been weeks? Has it been days?
No, I read it kind of in the very beginning of the summer, and I've just been giving it to everyone. Like everyone I know. So
awesome. That's a good friend who does that. All right, let's take another call. Ren from Hyde Park. Go ahead, Ren.
Hi. I'll try to be brief. I am actually going through my second reread right now of a book called Conspiracy of Truths by a local non-binary author named Alexandra Rowland. It actually came out last October, but I'm re-listening to the audiobook right now because the sequel is coming out in 2 weeks. It is a fantasy novel, but it is very smart and very funny, and it is about like the power of myth and fake news. It's just very smart and very funny. I really love it.
Excellent. Well, anytime somebody says this, I'm on my second time, you know it's something that really registered with them. We'll take one more. Catherine from Grafton, what's your recommendation?
Hey, I'd like to recommend another book by a local author. There's two in this series. The first one is called Little Comfort, and the second one just out this week is called The Missing Ones. And I had to stay up late both times to finish both of them. The star is a 4'9¾" librarian named Hester Thursby, and the author is Edwin Hill. They're fabulous end of summer books.
I love her already, Catherine. Thanks for that call. All right, so Nick, we've had a lot of fun with, you know, fiction, with local books. We did start this with me talking about my great intentions with those big nonfiction tomes that were sitting on my desk. Is there a nonfiction read that you would recommend for a reader who wants to sink their teeth in, but also kind of get lost in the subjects over this Labor Day weekend?
You know, there are a couple. One, The Ghosts of Eden Park by Karen Abbott, and Three Women by Lisa Tadeo. Ghosts of Eden Park is fabulous. It's about a bootlegger in the 20s that you haven't heard about, George Remus, but it's wonderful. It has everything that I want in a summer read. It's got whiskey, sex, and a loaded gun. And so
I love it.
Totally in. So that book is just terrific.
I just want to mark this. This is our new standard for summer reading. It has to have whiskey, sex, and a loaded gun. Let's
how
be
can
clear.
You go wrong? Cannot.
Looks like you were going to give us one other.
Three Women by Lisa Tadeo. Is an incredible journalistic feat. She spent almost 10 years with three different women exploring desire, because we all kind of accept that men desire ferociously, but if a woman dares to do that, suddenly, you know, society is going to shame her. So this book, I think, delves into the lives of three very, very different women. And I think hopefully, you know, peels back that mask a little bit so that we're not so judgmental. But both of those books are great.
1-800-423-8255. We've got time for a couple more calls. Let's take one. Jason from Malden, what do you recommend?
Hey, how are you today?
Good, thanks.
I'm calling. Awesome. So I'm calling. I'm in the middle of directing a show regarding Edgar Allan Poe in Saugus, Mass. And while I'm researching it, I'm realizing I haven't gone to any of his short stories or poetry since I was in school. And the more that I delve into it as an adult, I'm like, wow, what an amazing opportunity as adults to go back and revisit some of these macabre type stories that as an adult are just riveting. So that would be my recommendation. Definitely, if you're trying to get into the fall spirit, you know,
get a jump on Halloween.
Like I said, yes. I'm just blown away as an adult how timeless these short stories are. You know, they're sort of not mentioned in time, so they're relevant always.
That's a great recommendation. Thanks for that, Jason. Okay, so Jen, are there any books or authors that have really surprised you in particular this season, or that you think, hey, these books have not gotten the attention that they deserve?
That's a great question. I think my response to that would be that sometimes adults think they can't read YA because they're not teenagers, and that's it couldn't be further from the truth. I love reading YA. I write YA, and
I kind of love YA. I love YA.
Yes, yes. We were just talking about that, and so there's a book that I feel hasn't gotten such great attention, or it has, but it could always get more. It's a book, a YA novel called Barely Missing Everything. It's by Matt Mendez, and so this book is YA. It's told in three points of view by three teenagers who are living in El Paso, Texas. And so it's not the El Paso we know in the news right now. And what I like about that is that it's not specifically and directly engaging with recent current events. This book was published this year, but it was written probably then at least a couple of years ago. It's about three teens with three very specific desires, and they go on a road trip to try and get what they want. One wants to reunite with his father, who's in prison. One is a pregnant teenager. She's trying to figure out what to do. And one wants to be a famous film director. So the three of them jump in a car, and they're trying to help each other reach these goals. And I just love it because it's like cracking a window open, as we were talking about, into a city that is part of the United States, but many people might just see on the news. And it's horrific, everything that happened, but there's also other parts to El Paso, and this book is a great entry into that.
Nick, anything you want to add from the didn't get the attention it deserved?
You know, there's a new book called The Tenth Muse by Catherine Chung, which I think is absolutely amazing. The main character, also Catherine, both a K, is closer to her death than her birth, and so she's kind of looking back on her life. She's a mathematician. Her career started in MIT in the 60s when, of course, a woman in any of the sciences was a rarity, was often dismissed. But then suddenly thrown into that is questions about her parentage. Was her Chinese mother her mother? Was her white father really her father? It's terrific.
It sounds fascinating. That is Nick Petrolakis. He's the assistant manager of Brookline Booksmith. Thanks for being here today.
Thank you.
And Jennifer DeLeon, she edited the anthology Wise Latinas, Writers on Higher Education. She's an English professor at Framingham State and a writing instructor at Grub Street. Jennifer, thanks.
Thank you.
That is our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR. We're Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.